Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, it's the 1980s all over again as we take a look at the Netflix throwback horror series, Stranger Things. Then, as we move into the most difficult part of the year in which to wear a suit, we talk about weddings, the TV and movie spectacle that almost always means either lots of happiness or lots of misery. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
We've just wrapped up two of the biggest weeks of this year's presidential election, the Republican and Democratic National Conventions in Cleveland and Philadelphia. It's a lot to keep up with, but don't worry about it. All you need to do is keep up with the NPR Politics podcast. They've been at the conventions doing quick daily episodes first thing every morning. Know what's happening and what it means without the cable news hangover. Find the NPR Politics podcast on the NPR One app or at npr.org/podcasts.
It's Monsters and Weddings on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And with us this week as Glenn Weldon recovers from Comic-Con are two of our nearest and dearest, far away though they may be with us this week. From New York, Mike Katziff, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a producer for Ask Me Another.
And with us from WBEZ in Chicago at the moment is the usually Boston-based Margaret H. Wilson. Margaret, what do you do?
I am a librarian, and then I'm also one half of the Chibasi Games newsletter, one third of Appointment Television, the podcast, and currently like riding high off of having given a really successful speech at my best friend's wedding.
We are totally going to get back to that, and I will ask you more about it. So, we heard you. We aren't always able to do all the topics you guys wish we would, but this time when a lot of you cried out for coverage of the Netflix series Stranger Things, we couldn't resist. The series was created by the Duffer brothers, Matt and Ross, as their family no doubt calls them. I looked that up, by the way, as they are just billed as the Duffer brothers. They call it a love letter to the classic entertainment of the 1980s, particularly, I would say, Stephen King novels and Steven Spielberg movies. In the series, a young boy goes missing under spooky circumstances, and his mother, played incidentally by Winona Ryder, teams up with the sheriff on one track, while her missing son's friends meet up with a mysterious girl and take off on a different track, and her older son teams up with a high school friend to go in yet another direction. These three stories unfold over 8 episodes. It dropped on Netflix a couple of weeks ago as we tape this, so a lot of you have probably had a chance to see it. I think I'm going to go to the first of the people in our group who I knew of who had seen it was Mike. Mike, how did you enjoy this particular show?
It's fair to say that it was designed by an algorithm specifically for me.
Yep. Yeah.
There's something about like all these like reboots of all these movies where they're trying to target people who grew up on a thing that they love, and mm-hmm. now they're bringing it back. In some ways, you can make a case that this is doing that thing. It's bringing right. back things that I grew up watching or reading. Stephen King novels, as you said, Spielberg, and early Amblin Entertainment, so like The Goonies. John Carpenter is definitely an influence. I've seen it being called VHS core as like a sort of genre.
Funny.
I remember having maybe 3 or 4, 10 VHS tapes that we just
right.
watched over and over and over again. Sometimes it was Stand By Me or E.T., and sometimes it was It or
yeah.
The Thing.
And all of these things are referenced in
mm-hmm.
this.
Absolutely. And the kids are aware of this culture that's happening. So it's not happening within a bubble where none of this stuff exists.
Right.
All of these things are sort of influences on the show that is unfolding.
Right.
In the same way that like Quentin Tarantino pulls
right.
from the things
I
that
think
he
that's
loves.
Right. Yeah.
Or even The Sopranos pulled from gangster movies of that era.
Mm-hmm.
This is telling a new story with that. So it's not completely ripping off those movies.
Right.
It's working within that framework
yeah.
that is, for me anyway, super satisfying. And it doesn't forget to tell a story on top of it.
Yeah. How about you, Margaret? What'd you think?
Well, I think it's great that we have both me and Mike on the show because he's familiar intimately with all of these references and the show works for him. And here I am. I've never read a Stephen King novel. I've seen some Spielberg, but like not E.T. since I was a child and never Goonies.
Yeah.
Not a lot from this era that's clearly being referenced. And I still love the show. So I think it's great evidence that the show can work whether you're really embedded in the references or whether you're a little bit removed from them. So there's some stuff I'm picking up on, like a clear Close Encounters of the Third Kind vibe in the Winona Ryder storyline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
100%.
Which is a great narrative to see being given to a woman. But at the same time, I get to experience this a little bit more freshly. I know there's a bigger network of references that are being made, but I get to just absorb this story, and I think it's really well done. Especially the casting of the child actors, which is so hard.
Yeah.
Casting and directing of them has been exquisite.
Absolutely. How about you, Stephen? What do you think?
Well, yeah, Mike mentioned the algorithm. This thing was bred in a lab for me. I was 11 in the fall of 1983. I was so embedded in the references and culture of this movie that I was sitting there saying, I'm sorry, Sunglasses at Night, that came out in January of 1984. That would not have been on a car radio in late 1983.
Oh,
the Atari 2600, that would not have been the hot Christmas gift at the Christmas of 1983. That's when I got a ColecoVision, which was the best present I ever received as a child.
Oh,
so I'm sitting there like, I am probably too attuned.
I am those kids.
I did not play Dungeons and Dragons to the extent that these kids did, but this thing is perfectly constructed for me. And my reactions watching it overall, one was just what an age we live in, that in 2016
sure.
We just get plopped in our laps what is in effect the length of a movie trilogy that could have been ported straight out of 1983 that would have been a classic had it come out at that time. And people talk about like, oh, it's, you know, there are these reference points, oh, it's derivative or whatever, but it's like, so was a lot of the things that it was referencing.
Of course.
It is part of a continuum of that work, and to me is really faithful to it in a way that makes it stand alongside it. And the other thing that I love about it, we'll talk about lots of individual things that we like about it, but speaking as a whole, part of what I loved about this show is, you know, we recently talked about Mr. Robot, and we like Mr. Robot, but we were talking about how we feel like we're getting farther and farther away from a resolution. This functions as an 8-hour movie.
Yeah.
As it goes along, it starts to move toward a resolution. You can feel it resolving itself. It doesn't tie up absolutely everything. They're clearly setting themselves up for another season.
Yeah.
It is not done in this way like, we don't know how the hell we're going to end this thing.
Right, totally.
They know how they're going to end this thing. And as it gets into that 7th and 8th episode, it starts to tie up loose ends in a way I found so satisfying and so refreshing. Like, I don't know that I need 8 seasons of this.
Right.
I felt very satisfied in this as a finite story,
sure.
even though I can't wait to see more of it.
There's two things I would highlight about the way that it was structured that I really like. The first is that I think 8 episodes coming out to, you know, I think, as you said, probably between 6 and 7 hours is exactly the right length for this piece. And I think one of the things that has been a struggle for Netflix and some of these other outlets, as they've gone to these shorter seasons, they're down from 22 or 24 or whatever has been standard in a primetime full season, but they haven't necessarily taken advantage of the fact that you can make them whatever you want. It doesn't need to be 12 or 13 or even 10. And there have been things, I think, on streaming services where people have wondered, why does it even need to be 10 or 12?
Right.
And where there has been kind of bloat even in the middle of something that's only 12 or 13 episodes. So for me, the fact that they put it at 8 and therefore, as you say, it's not just that you can feel that it's coming toward a resolution, but it's resolving at just about the pace that I wanted, which I think is rare in television and will become, I think, less rare as they get better at coping with kind of these flexible season lengths. The other thing I really like about it is that three-story concept. And there's a bit in the production notes where they talk about the fact that in the minds of the creators, essentially, the adults, the mother, played by Winona Ryder, and the sheriff, are in a Spielberg movie where it's kind of about hope and sort of having to step up as an adult and find the answer to things in that kind of adult way. The kids are in a Stephen King novel in the way that he looks at and thinks about childhood. And the teenagers are in like a John Carpenter kind of horror movie of that same period, which I think is such a brilliant way to look at it. But at the same time, I think they're also cross-pollinating all of those things, particularly to me. The union of the Stephen King idea and the Steven Spielberg idea is such an interesting one because those guys do not have a great long history of working together, which is kind of weird. Steven Spielberg was an executive producer, as was Stephen King, of the TV series Under the Dome, which is based on a Stephen King novel. I don't necessarily know that that's either one of their best work,
right. But
they have really not brought their sensibilities together in the way that actually kind of, in retrospect, seems so obvious because as I was watching this, I was thinking, right, those are both writers. Those are both kind of creators for whom the primary emotion of interest is wonder. Mm-hmm. And the primary emotional unit of interest is friendship. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true across a lot of Stephen King work and a lot of Steven Spielberg work. And here you see how it kind of works together. And at the same time, I think the kids are engaging with the idea of a monster in a kid way.
Right.
The teenagers are engaging with it in a teenager way, that kind of weight of growing responsibility as you get older. And the adults are dealing with it with this kind of wariness that comes from all the things that have already happened to them.
And a fear, you know, fear and need to protect and bearing the weight of their past experiences.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I do want to talk about the performances in this thing, and
right.
particularly your lead adult performances. I think Winona Ryder, you know, we've talked a little bit when this show has come up about how nice it is to see Winona Ryder come back.
Yeah.
She really gets the big, more, most kind of acting. She is a mother whose child has been taken.
Right.
And she is fully immersed in the terror of that experience. And she's terrific.
And I think Margaret made the right comparison to Close Encounters in the sense that she's on that line of like, is she crazy or is she...
Right. She almost feels like an unreliable... She does feel like an unreliable narrator. Not that she's the narrator, but, but for a chunk of the show. To me, the person I just was stunned by how much I loved was David Harbour. As the sheriff. And I'd seen him, you know, we saw him in like The Equalizer. He was just like a heavy in The Equalizer.
He's also been on some, like, I knew him from like some Law and Order and stuff.
Yeah,
like
he's very much a Hey, It's That Guy.
Yeah. He's a Hey, It's That Guy. He's a character actor. He's got a little bit of a heavy brow, so he sometimes plays heavies. By like the third or fourth episode, I just could not look away from him. I thought he was so good, so subtle, and so commanding, and still complex.
Yeah. Margaret, you talked a little bit about the performances by kids on the show. Can you talk a little bit about any in particular?
So all of the children are doing an incredible job, but the one who's most striking to me is Dustin, who's played by Gaten Matarazzo.
Yes.
He's the type that's easiest to go wrong on because he's sort of the chubby kid. And one of the punchlines is they're like packing up weapons for their adventure for the trip. And he's just packed like every snack children ate in the 80s instead, which could really easy just read as like a fat joke, but it really doesn't. He's just so like vibrant and engaging as a screen presence.
And smart and good at things.
And smart. And good.
And brave.
He's a terrific character. And the child actor who's portraying him is just remarkable. I just want to cover him in hugs.
Yeah.
He looks like a human child, not like a tiny adult grown in a lab to sell me cereal.
I think that touch of reality just carries over to every character. It struck me with the kid who plays Mike. So Finn Wolfhard is the actor's name, Mike Wheeler.
Yep.
He's sort of the main lead of this. And there's a scene very early on where Mike first comes into contact with Elle, or Eleven, who's the girl. And we'll talk about her in a second, I'm sure.
Yeah.
He's trying to protect her in his house while his parents are away. And he's trying to entertain her and making her feel welcome and comfortable. But the things he's doing, he doesn't clearly understand yet. And a lot of these boys are the same way. They don't understand girls yet. So he's showing his action figures and his dinosaurs and explaining video games and snacks and all these things that they clearly love. But not only does she not understand any of these references or care, which would probably be true whether she was a girl in a
normal circumstance.
In a normal circumstance, right? Like most girls, if you did that at that age, would be like, I do not care at all about your dinosaur. You know, he's also helping her understand very like simple concepts like friendship or love,
promises.
Things like that. Yeah. Being a teenager is just on the horizon, but you're not quite there yet. So you're still a boy, but you're on like this echo tone of being in your childhood and also like looming teenagerness and then looming adulthood.
Yeah. And I do want to give a shout to Millie Brown, who plays Eleven. So Eleven is a girl who kind of appears in the story. She has a very unusual background that unfolds over the course of it. And I think this Millie Brown performance, I think what it calls for from her is a kind of opacity that is really difficult for kids, because it can't be like a dead-eyed opacity. It can't be like she's a doll, or you wouldn't be invested. She's very clearly a person, and you come to care about her a lot, and she speaks very little, but when she does, you get the sense of a wisdom, despite the fact that she doesn't talk very much. She doesn't feel like a magical person. She just feels like a person in unusual circumstances. And as Mike said, I would take up for the fact that I'm sure there were dinosaur girls and action figure girls
for
this time, but
she was not that girl.
She is not that girl. I think the point is, it's very difficult for Mike at the beginning to relate to her as an individual person. And I think that's part of what happens over the course of this story. And for me, watching her is so interesting because of all of those kind of odd dynamics that evolve with these boys.
Well, in many ways, she's kind of an analog for E.T.
That's right.
She is effectively E.T., and there are lots of little nods to E.T. in the way that she is treated, the way she is hidden from these shadowy authority figures, mm-hmm. the way mm-hmm. she is kind of told to stay in one place and sometimes gets out of that place. Mm-hmm. You have Eggo Waffles as a stand-in for Reese's Pieces.
Right.
Yeah. It's mm-hmm. like if E.T. looked like a young Furiosa from Mad Max Fury Road.
And I'll tell you, Furiosa, but also one of the references I find really interesting, and I can't imagine it's not on purpose. There is a shot of her when she kind of appears in the middle of a fight, when mm-hmm. she kind of all of a sudden there she is, that I think is a very direct nod to The Legend of Billie Jean, which mm-hmm. is a kind of beloved but culty kind of movie from the 80s, from 85, with Helen Slater playing this girl who gets together with her friends, and they have to kind of go up against, you know, the cops, and people are chasing them, and it's so in touch with this movie. And also, she shaves her head because she's inspired by Joan of Arc in a movie. Mm-hmm. And when I saw Eleven come out here, I thought, oh, that's Helen Slater in Legend of Billie Jean. There's a shot that's almost, it's so direct that I kind of want to screenshot it, and I'm going to see if I can pull that off.
There are a couple of little details of the way this show dispenses with certain characters and weights certain characters' struggles a little more heavily than others. I was a little frustrated with the treatment of Barb. Mm-hmm. on this show, as mm-hmm. opposed to how some of the other threatened characters are treated. Barb, to me, is treated very much like an afterthought.
Barb is I think we can say Barb is another character who's kind of imperiled as the original kid who disappears.
The friend of the teenage girl.
Right. And she's not, mm-hmm. but she's not as central to the story, the way they tell it.
Yeah, and in ways that, you know, she's going through the same thing this little kid is going through.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. As I said, a lot of you asked us to cover this. I know that a lot of you have seen it. I will be very curious to hear what you think. So come and find us at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, well, it's summertime. It's wedding season. We're going to talk a little bit about weddings in pop culture. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from iTunes Movies, with the Sundance hit Sing Street. From the filmmaker behind Once, Sing Street transports viewers to 80s Dublin as seen through the eyes of 14-year-old Connor, the schoolboy who starts a band to win his crush's heart. Steeped in the vibrant rock trends of that decade and inspired by director John Carney's own life, Sing Street is an invigorating reminder that music can transcend the turmoil of everyday life and transform us into something greater. Sing Street is available July 12th. Own it first on iTunes.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, I am pretty sure that as it gets to be summer, none of you will be surprised that we found it seasonal to take a moment and talk about weddings in pop culture, primarily in TV and movies, I suppose. And I'm going to take the unusual step of going first in this conversation, which I usually don't do. And I'm going to tell you that one that I came to the conclusion ultimately that maybe my favorite wedding in TV and movies, my favorite wedding scene, is a wedding that actually did not happen, which is at the very end of the first season of ER. Mm. Carol Hathaway, played by Juliana Margulies, who had started that season with a suicide attempt, in the season finale did not marry her boring boyfriend, and thank goodness she didn't. And so her friends and family went ahead with the reception. She dances with her father to Tequila. And it's really sweet. Her dad is not either like the bumbling dad or the punishing dad. He's mm-hmm. just a kind of loving dad who dances with her because it's her party and she's had a very hard year. She gives a little speech about how much she loves her friends. Tequila plays and you see everybody dancing. And then eventually it changes over to kind of mood music for the end of that season. And it's just a montage of people at this wedding and all the friendships that have been so deeply developed over the course of the season. Particularly, there are a bunch of really nice shots of Anthony Edwards and George Clooney. What I love about this scene is that it actually does something narratively in this story, which a lot of times the thing about weddings is they turn out to be kind of boring. They're all the same. You get vows, you get nervous people, then you get elements are the same. What I liked about this was this very unexpected scene where it winds up just being that it's a big life event.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point about weddings being boring. And and not just weddings themselves, but the pop culture readings of weddings tend to revolve around a few recurring tropes.
Right.
You have the cursed wedding, the late for our wedding, the break up the wedding, the a lot of these things that you see in these things time and time again. The person says the wrong thing. Does anybody have anything, reason these two should not be together? I do. The best wedding and the best way of looking at a wedding is it's just like a celebration of the, if you'll forgive the term, the journey of these two people, and a little bit of a celebration of all the work they had to do to get to that point. And so my favorite pop culture wedding, at least off the top of my head, was Jim and Pam in The Office.
Yes,
that's one of mine too.
The U.S. version of The Office, where you have all these mishaps and all this wackiness, and oh, is Michael Scott going to ruin everything? And like ultimately, they find a way to distill everything down to where it is just the experiences of these two people you like.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of stuff that gets me.
Sure.
It's, these people sacrificed a lot to get here. These people had to go through a lot to get here. And now here's a nice, tidy little moment. It is not the end of their story, but it's a nice marker and a way to roll around in the happiness of what has gotten them to this point.
Right. And I think the other thing about that wedding, too, is that to me, that episode was about the fact that you can't always have both the wedding that's a performance for everyone else and the wedding that is meaningful to you personally. Because what they really wind up doing is kind of dividing that experience so that the stakes of the wedding that is for everybody else are lower because they've also had one that's for themselves. And so then they're able to have kind of the party wedding where it doesn't really matter what other people do. There's such a nice moment in that episode when she has kind of a mishap with, I believe, the veil and it gets like a rip in it or something. So he cuts his tie because he's making the point to her kind of like that this is not the point. Like this is not what this is all about. And I think that's what I think is so lovely about that. Now, when we started talking about this, Mike said that he wasn't sure that he was a guy who watched a lot of weddings on movies and TV. Where did you come out on this, Michael?
Well, the more I rack my brain about it, I realize that there's so much TV and movies that inevitably setting an episode or a movie at a wedding or before a wedding is almost like setting it at Christmas. The wedding itself has nothing to do really, to me, with the actual story. So you have like your bridesmaids, your hangovers or whatever, which are like the lead up. Father the Bride is the lead up to it. You have, to me, the ones that I think are most interesting are like these bottle episodes where the entire reason you're bringing all these people together is to see all these characters interact, whether they clash, they fight, all these weird obstacles come in their way, and then everyone kind of overcomes it and celebrates. It's kind of an excuse for family dynamics. So in a lot of ways, you could set any movie in that way just to see how people would react in these heightened situations. So if there's problems with your friendships, Bridesmaids basically like heightens that by saying the wedding has nothing to do with what's happening besides it's an excuse to get these two characters to face off and realize that their friendship is changing.
Well, and when you're an adult, once you're out of college, I would say, given that the tendency of people to scatter, when do you see all your friends at the same time? A bunch of people who don't normally get to spend a lot of time together. Certainly for me, that's been weddings. And basically every picture of me and all my college friends since we graduated comes from somebody's wedding, with the exception of like maybe a reunion or two. But for the most part, they come from people's weddings. So those do wind up being extremely important moments. So other than the one where you gave the toast, Margaret, what other weddings do you particularly love?
Well, Jim and Pam was a big one for me, but my secondary mention is another Mike Schur joint, and it is not Leslie and Ben on Parks and Recreation, but it's actually April and Andy on Parks and Recreation.
I had that written down.
Oh, man.
Which is such a remarkable one because that is a couple that's sort of two characters designed to be comic relief who, through the grace of that show, grew depth, and they grew depth through their interaction with each other. And so that's why it's so appropriate that that wedding is kind of a sneak attack.
Right. So this is April and Andy. April is the kind of grumpy, almost gothy kind of intern character played by Aubrey Plaza. And Andy is the big, great big goofball, originally brought on as bad boyfriend of Anne, who was played by Rashida Jones, but ultimately, as played by Chris Pratt, became
just
so
a
lovable.
Big, goofy golden retriever.
So lovable. And so the two of them, in a very unlikely fashion, found their way to each other's hearts. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Margaret.
And the wedding is a surprise to all of their guests. They've just been invited over to a house party, and suddenly it's a wedding.
Hi, guys. Remember how I told you there was going to be a surprise later? Well, the surprise is you're not actually at a dinner party. You're at our wedding. All right, let's do this.
April walks down the aisle to April Come She Will by Simon and Garfunkel. If you weren't crying when that happened, I don't even know you.
April, come she will.
There's a certain look on Leslie's face that has a little bit of sadness and a little bit of happiness. Mm-hmm. And what that look has always said to me is, there's just nothing I can do about this. Mm-hmm. If this is a bad idea, it's a bad idea. And they're doing it, and it's sweet. And it's such a beautiful... I remember when I saw that shot of her, I said, that should be her Emmy right there.
Yeah.
And of course it never happened, but good pull there, Hula Hoop.
Thank you.
And one of the nice things that that brings up is so many weddings in pop culture, particularly any kind of fairy tale wedding, like literal fairy tale wedding, the wedding is set as this deadline. Like we need to break up the wedding between the princess and the horrible villainous, you know, prince over here. And it, you know, you burst and you have to break it up before, God forbid, the vows are spoken and they have to be married. And then presumably, like, it's the end. Everything terrible has happened. And I like it when that is inverted. Like, if they say the vows, they get married. There's a great line in an episode of The Simpsons where Apu gets married and they've gone through the whole thing. Like, it's an arranged marriage and they're not sure about it. And in the end, it's like, we actually kind of like each other. And then the kind of the punchline is sort of like, well, we could always get a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And treating a wedding as like something like, obviously it's important. Obviously you want to take it seriously. Obviously you don't want to marry the wrong person. But as part of the larger trajectory of life, you can survive if it doesn't ultimately work out.
I think a lot of older movies, they project like this perfectness that the wedding has to be perfect. And that's either deemed by the family itself or how big it is or all of like the frills and flourishes and whatever. And I think a lot of what it boils down to, whether it's Andy and April or Apu, or I've been thinking about this with like 5-year engagement too, where you can get so paralyzed by the indecision and whether it's the right time or the right moment. Do you have the right place and the right dress and all of those sort of things that become a lot of those movies that I don't watch? And I think that's a big turnoff. But there's something that 5-year engagement does, which
a movie, by the way, with Jason Segel, right?
And Jason Segel and Emily Blunt.
Yep.
And it basically boils down to make the wedding that is perfect for you.
Right.
They, after years and years of putting off this wedding, decide in ricochet, like spur of the moment decisions. Do you want this dress or do you want this dress? Do you want this or do you want this? And they do it in a park, and it's very, like this very climactic scene, and they just go ahead and just do it because they've decided that after all this time of all these like micro decisions and breakups and depression, all the stuff that like this sort of pressure of getting engaged and then getting married led to, all that mattered was the two of them being together, and they made it like this perfect little personal moment for themselves.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think it's a fair point.
I wanted to give a quick shout out to two particularly great courthouse weddings.
Oh, cool.
One that's played for dramatic intent, and I know Linda will like this one too, which is the wedding that happens in Brooklyn between Elish and her American beau, whose name is currently escaping me, which is a fascinating one because normally you think of weddings as the climactic finale of a story. And there it's very much the midway point. It is a choice that she's making, and you get this sense of its permanence and significance, but also you get the sense that, like, maybe it is a choice she will unmake.
Right. It's only one of the choices.
Yeah, it's only one of the choices. And I think that is such a fascinating thing to see and something you see very rarely. And then speaking to Mike's point about the personalization of weddings, the greatest courthouse marriage that I can think of in our pop culture is Liz Lemon and Chris Cross on 30 Rock. Where she gets married in her Princess Leia costume because, quote unquote, it's the only white dress she has. But you also see her mutter Gollum like, I'm a princess.
Yes.
Because it's maybe the white dress that Liz Lemon would most want to wear on her wedding day.
Yeah. Very often, weddings do come down on television to what is happening not just with the people who are involved in the wedding, but with everybody else, right?
Yes.
For example, 16 Candles sets a lot of its story of the Molly Ringwald character around kind of how left out she feels as her older sister is getting married and as there are all these kind of crazy wedding preparations. And I think you can then look at a movie like, and I've talked before about the fact that I really am a fan of 27 Dresses, which not a lot of people love, but I do.
I do also.
And a lot of that movie is about friendship. It's about the sacrifices of caring about other people enough that you get involved in their stuff. And weddings are often a story about showing up.
Yeah.
It occurred to me today that both Friends and Will and Grace, and probably other ones if I sat down and thought about it, begin with somebody not getting married,
right,
with somebody leaving the groom and then having to kind of start over again. And it becomes kind of, this is what it is to start fresh, is to dump someone at the altar.
Like, there's an entire show about it, Happy Endings, which I know is beloved of
that
me on this
is,
panel.
I knew there was another one that I wasn't thinking of, and that is exactly what it is. All right. Well, I will be curious. I want to hear about it. I want to hear what you think about pop culture weddings, what your favorites are. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week, our favorite segment of every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from LearnVest. LearnVest is an online financial advice company focused on empowering people nationwide to make smart decisions with their money. If you want to know how aggressively to pay down your student loans, LearnVest can help with that. If you want to know how much you should put aside for saving or contributing to your retirement account, yep, they're on it. They'll create a custom financial plan. Plus, they pair you with a financial planner to help keep you on track. To see a sample plan and get a $50 credit, go to learnvest.com/happy.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment every week. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, hit me with what's making you happy this week, buddy.
Well, in our A segment, I talked about kind of comparing Stranger Things to Mr. Robot in terms of structure. One other thing that Stranger Things has in common with Mr. Robot is tremendous use of music. There are currently two Mr. Robot soundtracks out that are capturing a lot of the music that has run through that show. The other thing is, we've talked on this show once before about the Netflix series BoJack Horseman, starring Will Arnett as a washed-up horse actor. Obviously, it's animated. That show has, you know, come back for a second season, and it recently came back for a third. And I had drifted away from it a little bit. I kind of got through the first season and then have always been meaning to catch up. But I'd been hearing good things about one of the episodes in this new season that, of course, got dropped entirely in one big block. Episode 4 of the third season is called Fish Out of Water, and it is set entirely under the sea. And of course, BoJack is a horse. So he's got... he's got like the big glass helmet on, and he has to go to this underwater film festival to try to sell his film Secretariat.
Oh, nice.
in which, of course, he is the star. But it is him attempting to interact with this terrifying and isolating, kind of lost in translation if Bill Murray were trying to deal with fish.
Sure.
It's so weird, and so much of it is wordless. There are lots of just hilarious fish sounds that run through it. I really liked that show when it first came out. I intend to go back and watch the whole thing through. But if you've drifted away from it and want to just dip your toe back into it, start with Fish Out of Water, the fourth episode of the third season, in which BoJack takes to the depths of the sea.
Nice. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Mike, what is making you happy this week?
So the thing that is making me happy is actually a documentary that's actually a very relatively pretty sad documentary. It's part of the ESPN 30 for 30 series. Mm. They make phenomenal work across like sports and pop culture. The latest one that I just watched was Doc and Daryl. It's directed by Judd Apatow and Michael Bonfiglio, who also directed the You Don't Know Bo Doc.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
This is about Daryl Strawberry and Dwight Doc Gooden. If anyone knows anything about those two players, they know that they were players for the Mets in the early 80s. They were part of like this dynamic resurgence of the Mets that led to the 1986 World Series run, a team that was full of crazy personalities and fights and over-celebration and drinking and partying and stuff like that. But of course, this documentary more or less uses that as like a tiny little sliver of a chapter on these two guys' lives, which strangely, like, they're not particularly close, but they have very parallel lives, both riddled with drug addiction and abuse, sexual assault scandals, rape allegations, things like that, broken families. Their lives have just been one sort of like one tragedy after another. So this documentary basically frames them as now, like current day, Daryl Strawberry and Doc Gooden meet at a diner and they're sort of like reflecting on, in some ways, their glory days, but with the full knowing that their glory days were also what undid them. Mm-hmm. If you strip away the sports, and in some ways, if you strip away the fame part of it, it's about addiction and it's about personality and people's internal struggles. And sometimes people don't get the happy endings that they were meant to.
Yeah. And what's it called?
It's literally just called Doc and Daryl.
Doc and Daryl, 30 for 30.
ESPN, probably still banging around somewhere.
Findable on ESPN. Thank you very much, Mike Katzeff. Margaret Willison, what is making you happy this week? Hula Hoop.
First off, like, Stephen, your promo really blew up my spot because I have just started listening to the NPR Politics podcast. Their coverage of the Republican convention was great, and I'm really looking forward to digging into the archive there. And then, speaking of podcasts, I have one other than Pop Culture Happy Hour that I contribute to called Appointment Television. And we just found out that we are going to be doing a live show at the Philadelphia Podcast Festival in August on August 20th at 4 p.m. If you're interested, we're going to be doing more in-depth stuff about Stranger Things over the coming weeks with our TV book club. So that'll be starting with next Thursday's episode. And then finally, I have been on a deep binge of a particular author's audiobooks. So there is a Canadian mystery writer named Louise Penny who writes these just north of cozy mysteries about the chief inspector of the Sûreté of Quebec, Inspector Amand Gamache. And they are books that take with equal seriousness the psychological iniquities of human beings and like the delicious meals one can eat in French Quebec. And the narrator, Ralph Cosham, does a really good job with the wide array of different accents that are going on. And they're perfect for this time of year because they give you a sense of cool, like temperatures, just plaids, flannels, cashmeres, and it's a great antidote to incredibly hot, humid weather that I'm experiencing in Boston. So I've listened to like six in the last 3 weeks, and I highly recommend them. So the first book in that series is called Still Life, and they are overall the Three Pines Mysteries by Louise Penny. They're good in print, but they're great on audio. So those are the things that are making me happy this week.
All right. Thank you very much, Margaret Willison. Making me happy this week, I have been watching a lot of Will and Grace on TV, and I have been talking about that a little bit on Twitter. I got to the finale this weekend in a binge watch. And the finale of that show, which aired in 2006, was definitely not perfect. It is a time jump finale, which I usually don't like in comedies. But there is an absolutely gorgeous, perfect moment plunked into this finale. Jessica, if you have my clip.
That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I
Oh boy. Love it, love it. That is Sean Hayes at the piano and Megan Mullally. If you watched that show, they were essentially the sidekicks. Sean Hayes played Jack and Megan Mullally played Karen. They were kind of the goofy, vulgar goofballs who also grew to be dear, dear, dear friends. And in this time jump finale, we find that Jack and Karen, through a series of events, have essentially wound up living together in great wealth. And from time to time, they just get up and she says, "I feel a song coming on." And he goes to the piano, by now his graying temples and his little glasses. And it is the most perfect way to send off a pair of characters that I've maybe ever seen on a finale, in the sense that they were so silly. But what that show was, despite the fact that it has a bunch of, there are a bunch of problems with kind of the politics of that show and the character of Jack and all of this stuff. But that show ultimately is built on the treatment of friendship as sacred. And for Jack and Karen, although they were goofballs, they were also extraordinarily loving to each other. And in the end, like Will and Grace, Jack and Karen have built their, essentially their happy lives on the strength of this loving relationship, which actually turns out to be more stable than Will and Grace's. Mm-hmm. As I said, not everything about those characters ever worked, but that moment is beautiful. And again, it's in the finale of Will and Grace, and seeing it and thinking about it again this week made me very, very happy. So take care of your dear friends out there. We are at the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Mike at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. You can follow Margaret at Mrs. Friday Next. That's M-R-S Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And of course, you know, Mike, who is on the show, is also our producer emeritus and music director. And Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. And we will see you right back here next week.